Welcome to the latest episode of Sustaining Sustainability series by EY India Insights podcast, commemorating World Environment Day. I'm Pallavi, your host for today's insightful conversation. Today's topic focuses on funding climate resilience, where we delve into how the financial sector navigates climate issues, reducing risks, and embracing environmental opportunities. To facilitate the conversation further, with us we have Hina Kushlani, EY India partner leading the financial service sector in climate change and sustainability services. She has been a sustainability practitioner for more than 16 years and brings us a wealth of experience across the US, South and Southeast Asia. Hina is very passionate about driving sustainable development through the lens of catalytic finance. Hina, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hina, to start off, I would like to ask, how do financial institutions assess the risks associated with climate change when considering investment or loans?
Sure. So, see, the truth is that, you know, climate change and specifically climate risk has been a conversation that's been ongoing at the global forums for almost more than, almost a decade or more. And financial institutions at the global level have certainly been able to integrate climate risk in some of their decision-making process. It's been a long road, and frankly, it's not perfect, but there's been a lot of practices. How much of that has translated to India? Frankly, India is at a very early stage at the moment when it comes to integrating climate risks in while considering investments. So I'll give you a quick layout of what climate risk means. I mean, there are two components to climate risk from an investment or a loan angle. One is the physical risk and one is a transition risk. A physical risk is if I'm investing in a particular entity, let that be a project, let that be a company, how much is that entity and their offices exposed to extreme weather, exposed to floods, earthquakes, and things like that, because the climate and weather patterns are changing, right? So how resilient is that company when it comes to physical risks? Because the damages for a lender like, you know, for a bank would be if that company loses some of their key assets due to climate risk, their ability to repay the loan payments is going to be limited. And hence, that's on the physical risk side. On the transition risk, there are multiple different components. There's the technology risk, there's the regulation risk, there is the reputation risk, there's the customer preferences risk. So there's quite a bit. Transition risk is a much larger segment. Typically, what it means is that if I'm lending to a company that is in a sector like, say, steel, and so steel as a sector is highly exposed. It's a hard to abate sector, which means its emissions are quite high. And with that being said, so the sector is also exposed to a lot of risks when it comes to global regulations on climate change. Carbon tax in EU has impacted the steel sector in India already. We're also talking about specifically the technology. So the companies here need to keep up with the technology and make it more efficient, energy efficient, so that they're able to compete globally when it comes to both pricing and technologies. So these are the two kind of risks, and how do lenders look at it? There are multiple ways a bank or in any financial institution can integrate climate risk. One, it's integrated in the traditional financial models, where they look at specifically looking at the adjusted returns and things like that. It's also integrated in the credit risk assessment. And again, credit risk is what I mentioned in terms of the ability of that party to be able to pay back. They also do regular stress testing, and that's what, so RBI in India has come up with a regulation where banks and financial institutions need to do regular stress testing. It's not mandated yet, it's still in the draft stage, but we're hoping to get a confirmation on this sometime in 2024. And post that regulation is when Indian banks are already starting to gear up to do regular stress testing in their portfolios to look at how much of their portfolio is exposed to the risk of climate risk. One is when you assess, and two is how you prepare to reduce your risk, right? And that's where they're going to have to start looking at, banks start looking at every single loan that they're giving, in terms of what are the ESG risks that they're exposed to in some form, what is the company doing about it? Maybe in some cases, they will take the ESG as a part of the key decision criteria. So to keep it very brief, I would say at the global level, we've definitely seen ESG risks and climate risk being integrated in decision-making, whether the loan should be given or not. In India, we haven't seen that fully translated yet, but it's just a matter of time because we're expecting regulations and the banks will move faster.
Thank you, Hina, for those detailed insights. Now, what innovative financing solutions are being employed to support projects aimed at climate resilience?
Sure. So frankly, see, I want to first define what is climate risk and what do we talk about? Like, what does resilience mean, right? So there are two components when it comes to climate risk. One is mitigation of the risk, and one is, so there's climate mitigation, and then there's adaptation and resilience. Sometimes, you know, adaptation and resilience is kind of switched as words also in the investment community. On the mitigation side is where we see a lot of funding flowing already. And that's where the renewable energy infrastructure, you know, all those, the EV and mobility investments, some of these fall under the mitigation category. And we've seen a certain amount of private and public capital going there, and that's kind of, you know, going well so far. But I mean, of course, there's a huge funding gap overall, but if we compare mitigation to adaptation and resilience, mitigation is doing much better. Adaptation and resilience specifically, what does it mean? It means that specifically certain areas, like, you know, how do we adapt ourselves to the new reality of the climate change, which is the changing weather patterns. There are certain areas or certain sectors that will be more vulnerable compared to the others, right? So there is specifically 3-4 sectors. We know agriculture as a sector is highly exposed to the risks of climate change. We know that health and biodiversity is also going to be exposed. There's disaster management. So infrastructure financing also needs to take into account climate risks because, these are all highly exposed. And how do these sectors or these areas adapt to climate change and is what we're discussing right now, which is a component of the larger climate financing. So under climate finance, there's mitigation and there's adaptation resilience. Now that we've understood what is adaptation and resilience and which sectors specifically, you know, need a lot of funding and need support on this, is that there are multiple ways. So frankly, there are different ways of financing resilience. There are the traditional ways, which is the, you know, the bonds, there'll be concessional debt to some extent, there'll be loans, equity. Now, climate resilience in some form is driven traditionally by the governments, which is the state and the central. In India specifically, it's a part of the state mandate. But with that being said, there are a lot of our states which already have a budget deficit, you know. So how do they finance climate resilience is a problem. And this is where we're starting to suggest, and globally, climate resilience needs to be funded with blended finance, which is there needs to be some innovation that's happening in some of these, financing instruments. For example, there are outcome-based instruments, which is like, which is sustainability-linked bonds, debt for nature swaps. Now, what does a debt for nature swap mean? Basically, this is primarily used at the sovereign level, so at the country level, if a country is able to prove or achieve certain conservation outcomes or certain outcomes that are related to climate resilience, then the loan or the sovereign loan that country has, they'll get a concession on it. Very similarly, it's a sustainability linked bond is for a company. So if as a bank, a bank ABC is funding, a specific company and in that loan document or a bond, it can be sustainability linked loans or bonds. And the bonds is also where the fundraising is attached to certain KPIs saying I will achieve. I will invest in energy efficiency. I will invest in climate risk resilience in all my plants and manufacturing sites. And if I'm able to do this, then I should get a certain amount of, benefit from the financial institution. And that's sustainability-linked bond where a company gets some financial benefit for achieving these climate resilience targets, you know. So this is where the outcome-based instruments come in. There is, of course, blended finance is a much larger term that's used across different kinds of instruments. There's catalytic investments like just simple risk guarantees, you know. So this is, again, used mostly at the state and at the company level. A risk guarantee is to say that, there are different partners that come in blended finance. Blended finance is where you are bringing a public part, a public stakeholder, a private company, a private investor, sorry, a philanthropic investor together in one particular transaction so that each one can de-risk the other. Like, for example, a risk guarantee, the way it works is that, if a company or a state is taking up a loan, which, the reason adaptation and resilience has not been able to raise funds, I mean, there are certain challenges. And one is certainly an information gap. There's a lot of, there's no data available as to what are the vulnerable sectors, what are the vulnerable industries, what are the vulnerable areas. We need a common platform to tell us, one, what is vulnerable. Like, if I'm a bank, I need to have a common platform that I can refer to say, these are the areas that are high in climate risk, these are the sectors, these are, specifically, what is a common terminology? How do we go about the common understanding? Then there's a lot of uncertainty on the investment returns. There's basically not a lot of knowledge when it comes to how do you quantify these returns and quantify this risk in some form. And one of the reasons is that one of the reasons this area has not received any funding so far and it needs innovation is because the common language of how do you measure a climate risk, the common language of how do you increase the bankability of some of these projects is all missing. And this is where we need some innovation in terms of designing these instruments, and we need multiple different stakeholders to come and de-risk each other, to come and launch some of the newer kind of financing projects here. So risk guarantee is one where specifically a larger multi-development bank or maybe multilateral bank or some a larger institution risks a particular transaction, saying, if bank XYZ is funding this a company A, it's a very high risk transaction, but there will be another, say, a company like an ADB or any other multilateral development bank that will come and be the first loss guarantee here in some form, saying that, you go ahead and give the loan. And if there is a loss, then I'll be the first one to take that loss. And I will. So the bank's losses reduce. So we need some of these very interesting, and frankly, these are not very new ideas. The problem is they haven't scaled. And we really need parties to come together saying, how about really piloting some of these instruments? Some of them have happened at the global level. We need to pilot them in India and not everything's directly translatable. I mean, we have to contextualize some of these instruments. Some may be more successful, some may not be. There's parametric insurance as well. There's so much that we can do specifically from an instrument launching innovative financing, but we really need a forum in India where we're able to put this together and basically pilot some of these instruments together. That's a quick brief on this one.
Thank you, Hina. Adding to the previous question, could you also discuss some examples or models of case studies where funding has significantly contributed to enhancing climate resilience?
Sure. So, see, the truth is, I have to say climate resilience is currently at an extremely nascent stage of funding. In fact, most actors who are currently working in the field the only argument that they have is that currently there's barely any funding moving. The funding gap is huge. So in order to say that if there's anything that's worked successfully is a bit difficult. I don't think there is any specific model that's been successful and scaled. Are there models? Yes. Like, for example, there are a lot of blue bonds and conservation bonds that are being raised by state governments and municipalities in different countries. There's one in Brazil that was launched, a few years ago, and that's been going well. There's also, in terms of the leading recent practices of what's working, there's something called the Asia Pacific Climate Finance Fund that's been supported by multi-donor. It's a multi-donor trust fund. It's being anchored by ADB. And so specifically what this kind of climate finance fund does is bring the funds from different agencies and be able to support everything from a sustainable insurance facility and supporting how a potential business model insurance product design can happen. So what ACLIF is doing, which is the Asia Pacific Climate Finance Facility, what it's specifically looking at is supporting the development of products to manage financial risks. And that's where being able to work with different organizations in modeling new products, let that be on the banking side or let that be on the insurance side, is important. And we need more models like this, and funds where different parties are able to come together and really pilot some of this, like I mentioned earlier, and at the same, frankly, there is activity for sure. I have to say that I'm not, but a lot of it currently is coming from the multilateral development banks, the likes of World Bank, ADB, AIFF. And so there's a little bit happening at the national level. In fact, some of the key gaps in India that we need to fill is certainly for the central central finance ministry to be able to focus on adaptation funding as a key component. Because unless and until the government push is there, we won't be able to, frankly, scale any of this.
Thank you, Hina. Now, pivoting towards the terms of policy and regulation, what changes are necessary to encourage more investment in climate resilient infrastructure and technologies?
So I'd like to give this an India specific take, that's the market that we're operating in right now. There are two key policy gaps in India that needs to be filled. And the good thing is that the government has a strong focus. We all know that climate change is one of the key challenges that we're facing. As we continue to grow as an economy, a lot of our growth can be stalled or frankly taken, like we're going to reverse our growth if we don't focus on climate change. And when we say don't focus, it's important both mitigation and adaptation and resilience. I mean, I ran a number somewhere which said that India could lose 30 trillion in the next 25, 30 years if we don't focus on climate resilience, because of the impact of climate change. So the government has two key policies to take a look, to review in terms of supporting increase in investments on the resilience side. And I'm talking about this both from the private investment angle as well as from the public investment angle. One is that currently, like I mentioned, a lot of the climate resilience activity in India is anchored by the states. And, the states don't necessarily, one, have the know-how to access the innovative financing instruments. Two, they don't have the funds available to anchor some of this work. And some of the states are definitely more vulnerable to climate change compared to the others, like Maharashtra, I'm sorry, like Odisha, I think is certainly one of the more vulnerable ones. But for them to be able to allocate a certain amount of budgets towards climate adaptation and resilience will require support from the central Ministry of Finance, So that's where the Finance Commission in India, when we're looking at the plans for the next 5 years, we certainly need to put a certain amount of focus on adaptation financing in the states and being able to support that. Two, blended finance is going to be in some form playing a key role when it comes to filling the climate finance gap. Let that be in India, let that be globally. India is looking to raise 10 trillion to fund their climate, to achieve net zero by 2070. Now, there's absolutely no way India can achieve net zero without private finance being in the room, right? And private finance, like I mentioned, there's a lot of challenges. And that's why there's private finance not moving towards adaptation resilience. So what needs to be done for private finance to move towards climate adaptation and resilience? And that's where we need blended finance as the... So basically, private finance is saying that we would be willing to support, but we need somebody to reduce the risk for us. And that's where a blended finance instrument and philanthropic capital in India can be leveraged. Now, there are certain laws, specifically the CSR law of India does not, there's a lot of CSR funding that's every year. India is one of the only countries in the world that's mandated corporate social responsibility and spend on it, the 2% of the net profits every year. So there is a good amount of budget or rather funds, philanthropic, that are available to support blended finance in this area. But the laws and the policies don't allow companies to participate in impact or blended finance kind of transactions. So the policies need to change a little bit where, you know, the CSR funds can be utilized for blended finance, can be utilized for impact finance, and this will accelerate, you know, there's a ready pool of capital that's available in some form to de-risk and to pilot some of these transactions. So these are the two areas that I believe we need policy changes in India.
Thank you, Hina. We did discuss about the risks and, you know, the policy and regulation and the importance of blended finance. According to you, how does one balance the demand for immediate financial returns with long-term goal of achieving sustainability and resilience in the face of climate change?
So, frankly, there's no silver bullet here, or there's no right or wrong answer. I think it's most importantly, the first step that we need to take is awareness on climate change and climate finance, the importance of this across all stakeholders. I mean, unless and until a shareholder of the institution understands, they won't be, you know, the pressure on the companies to give the highest returns to the shareholders, that needs to be a bit more realistic. I mean, shareholders need to understand that in some form, they will have to look at more of a long-term horizon instead of a short-term returns, you know. I think because the damage for a company from climate risks and climate change could also reduce a company's profits over a longer term. So hence, there needs to be I think education across all stakeholders, starting with shareholders, then investors and financiers, the companies and their executives. We need a certain amount of awareness and commitment across all stakeholders, and that's only when we can balance, you know, the financial returns with long-term goals. Or there are policies, you know, there's a carrot or a stick approach. Now, policies can either incentivize companies that are looking at, you know, that are giving a good financial return, but with also managing the long-term risks. Or there's a stick approach if the companies are not adhering to managing the climate change and risks. And this will not be uniform, frankly, across the board. This will probably be more, I would say, this has to be a bit more stringent on companies that are operating in the hard to abate sectors, or in the companies that have the highest exposure to climate risks. And those are the companies who will probably see a certain amount of pressure on them to manage the immediate financial returns. And that's precisely where even the shareholders of those companies will have to, shareholders and financiers actually, will have to understand about balancing the immediate short-term returns with long-term gains.
Thank you, Hina. That brings us to the end of today's episode. Thank you once again for joining us and sharing all your valuable insights to all our listeners.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
On that note, thank you to all our listeners. Join us next time as we continue to explore the confluence of sustainable practice and the financial acumen here on Sustaining Sustainability series. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast across all our platforms for more discussions like this. Until next time, goodbye. This is Pallavi signing off.